then. I have suffered so much more than I needed to, and the joys I have felt have not always been joyous. I could have lived differently. When I was your age, my grandfather bought me a ruby bracelet. It was too big for me and would slide up and down my arm. It was almost a necklace. He told me later that he had asked the jeweler to make it that way. Its size was supposed to be a symbol of his love. More rubies, more love. But I could not wear it comfortably. I could not wear it at all. So here is the point of everything I have been trying to say. If I were to give a bracelet to you now, I would measure your wrist twice. With love, your grandmother. I had a letter from everyone I knew. I laid them out on my bedroom floor and organized them by what they shared. 100 letters. I was always moving them around, trying to make connections. I wanted to understand. 7 years later, a childhood friend reappeared at the moment I most needed him. I had been in America for only 2 months. An agency was supporting me, but soon I would have to support myself. I did not know how to support myself. I read newspapers and magazines all day long. I wanted to learn idioms. I wanted to become a real American. Chew the fat. Blow off some steam. Close, but no cigar. Rings a bell. I must have sounded ridiculous. I only wanted to be natural. I gave up on that. I had not seen him since I lost everything. I had not thought of him. He and my older sister Anna were friends. I came upon them kissing one afternoon in the field behind the shed behind our house. It made me so excited. I felt as if I were kissing someone. I had never kissed anyone. I was more excited than if it had been me. Our house was small. Anna and I shared a bed. That night I told her what I had seen. She made me promise never to speak a word about it. I promised her. She said, "Why should I believe you?" I wanted to tell her because what I saw would no longer be mine if I talked about it. I said, "Because I am your sister." "Thank you. Can I watch you kiss?"
"Can you watch us kiss? You could tell me where you are going to kiss, and I could hide and watch."
She laughed enough to migrate an entire flock of birds. That was how she said yes. Sometimes it was in the field behind the shed behind our house. Sometimes it was behind the brick wall in the schoolyard. It was always behind something. I wondered if she told him. I wondered if she could feel me watching them, if that made it more exciting for her. Why did I ask to watch? Why did she agree? I had gone to him when I was trying to learn more about the forced laborer. I'd gone to everyone. "To Anna's sweet little sister, here is the letter you asked for. I am almost 2 meters in height. My eyes are brown. I have been told that my hands are big. I want to be a sculptor, and I want to marry your sister. Those are my only dreams. I could write more, but that is all that matters. Your friend, Thomas." I walked into a bakery 7 years later, and there he was. He had dogs at his feet and a bird in a cage beside him. The 7 years were not 7 years. They were not 700 years. Their length could not be measured in years, just as an ocean could not explain the distance we had traveled, just as the dead can never be counted. I wanted to run away from him, and I wanted to go right up next to him. I went right up next to him. "Are you Thomas?" I asked. He shook his head no.
"You are," I said. "I know you are."
He shook his head no.
"From Dresden."
He opened his right hand, which had no tattooed on it.
"I remember you. I used to watch you kiss my sister."
He took out a little book and wrote, "I don't speak. I'm sorry." That made me cry. He wiped away my tears, but he did not admit to being who he was. He never did. We spent the afternoon together. The whole time I wanted to touch him. I felt so deeply for this person that I had not seen in so long. 7 years before, he had been a giant, and now he seemed small. I wanted to give him the money that the agency had given me. I did not need to tell him my story, but I needed to listen to his. I wanted to protect him, which I was sure I could do, even if I could not protect myself. I asked, "Did you become a sculptor, like you dreamed?" He showed me his right hand, and there was silence. We had everything to say to each other, but no ways to say it. He wrote, "Are you okay?" I told him, "My eyes are crummy." He wrote, "But are you okay?" I told him, "That's a very complicated question." He wrote, "That's a very simple answer." I asked, "Are you okay?" He wrote, "Some mornings I wake up feeling grateful." We talked for hours, but we just kept repeating those same things over and over. Our cups emptied, the day emptied. I was more alone than if I had been alone. We were about to go in different directions. We did not know how to do anything else. "It's getting late," I said. He showed me his left hand, which had "yes" tattooed on it. I said, "I should probably go home." He flipped back through his book and pointed at, "Are you okay?" I nodded, "Yes." I started to walk off. I was going to walk to the Hudson River and keep walking. I would carry the biggest stone I could and let my lungs fill with water. But then I heard him clapping his hands behind me. I went to him. He asked if I would pose for him. He wrote his question in German, and it wasn't until then that I realized he had been writing in English all afternoon and that I had been speaking English. "Yes," I said in German. "Yes." We made arrangements for the next day. His apartment was like a zoo. There were animals everywhere. Dogs and cats, a dozen bird cages, fish tanks, glass boxes with snakes and lizards and insects, mice in cages so the cats wouldn't get them, like Noah's Ark. But he kept one corner clean and bright. He said he was saving the space. For what?
For sculptures. I wanted to know from what or from whom, but I did not ask. He led me by the hand. We talked for half an hour about what he wanted to make. I told him I would do whatever he needed. We drank coffee. He wrote that he had not made a sculpture in America. "Why not?" "I haven't been able to." "Why not?" We never talked about the past. He opened the flue, although I didn't know why. Birds sang in the other room. I took off my clothes. I went onto the couch. He stared at me. It was the first time I had ever been naked in front of a man. I wondered if he knew that. He came over and moved my body like I was a doll. He put my hands behind my head. He bent my right leg a little. I assumed his hands were so rough from all of the sculptures he used to make. He lowered my chin.
He turned my palms up. His attention filled the hole in the middle of me. I went back the next day, and the next day. I stopped looking for a job. All that mattered was him looking at me. I was prepared to fall apart if it came to that. Each time it was the same. He would talk about what he wanted to make. I would tell him I would do whatever he needed. We would drink coffee. We would never talk about the past. He would open the flue. The birds would sing in the other room. I would undress. He would position me. He would sculpt me. Sometimes I would think about those 100 letters laid across my bedroom floor. If I hadn't collected them, would our house have burned less brightly? I looked at the sculptor after every session. He went to feed the animals. He let me be alone with it, although I never asked him for privacy. He understood. After only a few sessions, it became clear that he was sculpting Anna. He was trying to remake the girl he knew 7 years before. He looked at me as he sculpted, but he saw her. The positioning took longer and longer. He touched more of me. He moved me around more. He spent 10 full minutes bending and unbending my knee. He closed and unclosed my hands. "I hope this does not embarrass you," he wrote in German in his little book. "No," I said in German. "No." He folded one of my arms. He straightened one of my arms. The next week he touched my hair for what might have been 5 or 50 minutes. He wrote, "I am looking for an acceptable compromise." I wanted to know how he lived through that night. He touched my breasts, easing them apart. "I think this will be good," he wrote. I wanted to know what will be good. How will it be good? He touched me all over. I can tell you these things because I am not ashamed of them, because I learned from them, and I trust you to understand me. You are the only one I trust, Oscar. The positioning was the sculpting. He was sculpting me. He was trying to make me so he could fall in love with me. He spread my legs. His palms pressed gently at the insides of my thighs. My thighs pressed back. His palms pressed out. Birds were singing in the other room. We were looking for an acceptable compromise. The next week he held the backs of my legs, and the next week he was behind me. It was the first time I had ever made love. I wondered if he knew that. It felt like crying. I wondered, why does anyone ever make love? I looked at the unfinished sculpture of my sister, and the unfinished girl looked back at me. Why does anyone ever make love? We walked together to the bakery where we first met. Together and separately. We sat at a table. On the same side, facing the windows. I did not need to know if he could love me. I needed to know if he could need me. I flipped to the next blank page of his little book and wrote, "Please marry me." He looked at his hands. Yes and no. Why does anyone ever make love? He took his pen and wrote on the next and last page, "No children." That was our first rule. I told him, in English, "I understand." We never used German again. The next day, your grandfather and I were married.
The only animal. I read the first chapter of A Brief History of Time when Dad was still alive, and I got incredibly heavy boots about how relatively insignificant life is, and how, compared to the universe and compared to time, it didn't even matter if I existed at all. When Dad was tucking me in that night, and we were talking about the book, I asked if he could think of a solution to that problem.
Which problem?
The problem of how relatively insignificant we are. He said,
"Well, what would happen if a plane dropped you in the middle of the Sahara Desert, and you picked up a single grain of sand with tweezers and moved it 1 millimeter?" I said, "I'd probably die of dehydration." He said, "I just mean right then, when you moved that single grain of sand. What would that mean?" I said, "I don't know, what?" He said, "Think about it." I thought about it. I guess I would have moved a grain of sand.
Which would mean?
Which would mean I moved a grain of sand?
Which would mean you changed the Sahara.
So?
So? So the Sahara's a vast desert, and it has existed for millions of years, and you changed it.
That's true, I said, sitting up. I changed the Sahara.
Which means, he said,
what, tell me.
Well, I'm not talking about painting the Mona Lisa or curing cancer. I'm just talking about moving that one grain of sand 1 millimeter.
Yeah.
If you hadn't done it, human history would have been one way.
Right.
But you did do it.
So?
I stood on the bed, pointed my fingers at the fake stars, and screamed, "I changed the course of human history!"
That's right.
I changed the universe!
You did.
I'm God!
You're an atheist.
I don't exist!
I fell back onto the bed, into his arms, and we cracked up together.
That was kinda how I felt when I decided that I would meet every person in New York with the last name Black. Even if it was relatively insignificant, it was something, and I needed to do something, like sharks who die if they don't swim, which I know about. Anyway, I decided that I'd go through the names alphabetically, from Aaron to Zina, even though it would have been a more efficient method to do it by geographical zones. Another thing I decided was that I would be as secretive about my mission as I could at home, and as honest about it as I could outside home, because that's what was necessary. So if Mom asked me, "Where are you going and when will you be back?" I'd tell her, "Out, later." But if one of the Blacks wanted to know something, I would tell everything. My other rules were that I wouldn't be sexist again, or racist, or ageist, or homophobic, or overly wimpy, or discriminatory to handicapped people or mental retards, and also that I wouldn't lie unless I absolutely had to, which I did a lot. I put together a special field kit with some of the things I was going to need, like a Magnum flashlight, chapstick, some Fig Newtons, plastic bags for important evidence and litter, my cell phone, the script for Hamlet so I could memorize my stage directions while I was going from one place to another because I didn't have any lines to memorize, a topographical map of New York, iodine pills in case of a dirty bomb, my white gloves, obviously, a couple of boxes of Juicy Juice, a magnifying glass, my LaRousse pocket dictionary, and a bunch of other useful stuff. I was ready to go. On my way out, Stan said,
"What a day."
I said, "Yeah."
He asked,
"What's on the menu?"
I showed him the key. He said,
"Locks?"
I said, "Hilarious, but I don't eat anything with parents."
He shook his head and said, "I couldn't help myself. So, what's on the menu?"
Queens and Greenwich Village.
You mean Greenwich Village?
That was my first disappointment of the expedition, because I thought it was pronounced phonetically, which would have been a fascinating clue. Anyway, it took me 3 hours and 41 minutes to walk to Aran Black, because public transportation makes me panicky, even though walking over bridges also makes me panicky. Dad used to say that sometimes you have to put your fears in order, and that was one of those times. I walked across Amsterdam Avenue and Columbus Avenue and Central Park, and Fifth Avenue and Madison Avenue and Park Avenue and Lexington Avenue and Third Avenue and Second Avenue. When I was exactly halfway across the 59th Street Bridge, I thought about how a millimeter behind me was Manhattan, and a millimeter in front of me was Queens. So what's the name of the parts of New York, exactly halfway through the Midtown Tunnel, exactly halfway over the Brooklyn Bridge, the exact middle of the Staten Island Ferry when it's exactly halfway between Manhattan and Staten Island, that aren't in any borough? I took a step forward, and it was my first time in Queens. I walked through Long Island City, Woodside, Elmhurst, and Jackson Heights. I shook my tambourine the whole time, because it helped me remember that even though I was going through different neighborhoods, I was still me. When I finally got to the building, I couldn't figure out where the doorman was. At first, I thought maybe he was just getting some coffee, but I waited around for a few minutes, and he didn't come. I looked through the door and saw that there was no desk for him. I thought, weird. I tried my key in the lock, but it didn't go in past the tip. I saw a device with a button for each apartment, so I pressed the button for A. Black's apartment, which was 9E. No one answered. I pressed it again. Nothing. I held down the buzzer for 15 seconds. Still nothing. I sat down on the ground and wondered if it would be overly wimpy to cry in the lobby of an apartment building in Corona.
"All right, all right," a voice said from the intercom. "Take it easy."
I jumped up. "Hello," I said. "My name is Oscar Schell."
"What do you want?"
His voice sounded mad, but I hadn't done anything wrong. "Did you know Thomas Schell?"
"No."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes."
"Do you know anything about a key?"
"What do you want?"
"I didn't do anything wrong."
"What do you want?"
"I found a key," I said, "and it was in an envelope with your name on it."
"Aran Black?"
"No, just Black."
"It's a common name."
"I know."
"And a color."
"Obviously."
"Goodbye,"
the voice said.
"But I'm just trying to find out about this key."
"Goodbye."
"But goodbye."
Disappointment number two. I sat back down and started to cry in the lobby of an apartment building in Corona. I wanted to press all of the buttons on the intercom and scream curse words at everybody. I wanted to give myself bruises. I stood up and pressed 9E again. This time, the voice came out immediately.
"What do you want?"
I said, "Thomas Schell was my dad."
"And?"
"Was. Not is. He's dead." He didn't say anything, but I knew he was pressing the talk button because I could hear a beeping in his apartment, and also windows rattling from the same breeze that I was feeling at ground level. He asked,
"How old are you?"
I said 7, because I wanted him to feel more sorry for me so he'd help me. Lie number 34. "My dad's dead," I told him.
"Dead?"
"He's inanimate." He didn't say anything. I heard more beeping.
We just stood there, facing each other, but 9 floors apart.
Finally, he said,
"He must have died young."
"Yeah."
How old was he?
40.
That's too young.
That's true.
Can I ask how he died?
I didn't want to talk about it, but I remembered the promises I made to myself about my search, so I told him everything. I heard more beeping and wondered if his finger was getting tired.
He said, "If you come up, I'll have a look at that key."
I can't go up.
Why not?
Because you're on the 9th floor and I don't go that high.
Why not?
It isn't safe.
But it's perfectly safe here.
Until something happens, it is.
You'll be fine. It's a rule. I'd come down for you, he said, but I just can't.
Why not?
I'm very sick.
But my dad is dead.
I'm hooked up to all sorts of machines. That's why it took me so long to get to the intercom.
If I could do it again, I'd do it differently. But you can't do it again. I heard the voice saying,
"Hello? Hello? Please."
I slid my card under the apartment building door and got away from there as fast as I could. Abby Black lived in number 1 in a townhouse on Bedford Street. It took me 2 hours and 23 minutes to walk there, and my hand got exhausted from shaking my tambourine.
There was a little sign above the door that said the poet Edna St. Vincent Millay once lived in the house, and that it was the narrowest house in New York. I wondered if Edna St. Vincent Millay was a man or a woman. I tried the key, and it went in halfway, but then it stopped. I knocked. No one answered, even though I could hear someone talking inside, and I guessed that number 1 meant the first floor, so I knocked again. I was willing to be annoying if that's what was necessary. A woman opened the door and said, "Can I help you?" She was incredibly beautiful, with a face like Mom's, which seemed to be smiling even when she wasn't smiling, and huge boobs. I especially liked how her earrings sometimes touched her neck. It made me wish all of a sudden that I'd brought some kind of invention for her so that she'd have a reason to like me, even something small and simple like a phosphorus brooch. "Hi."
"Hello."
"Are you Abby Black?"
"Yes."
"I'm Oscar Schell."
"Hello."
"Hi." I told her, "I'm sure people tell you this constantly, but if you looked up incredibly beautiful in the dictionary, there'd be a picture of you." She cracked up a bit and said,
"People never tell me that."
"I bet they do." She cracked up a bit more.
"They don't."
"Then you hang out with the wrong people."
"You might be right about that.
Because you're incredibly beautiful." She opened the door a bit more. I asked, "Did you know Thomas Schell?"
"Excuse me?"
"Did you know Thomas Schell?" She thought. I wondered why she had to think.
"No."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes."
There was something unsure about the way she said she was sure, which made me think that maybe she was keeping some sort of secret from me. So what would that secret be? I handed her the envelope and said, "Does this mean anything to you?" She looked at it for a while.
"I don't think so. Should it?"
"Only if it does," I told her.
"It doesn't," she told me.
I didn't believe her. "Would it be okay if I came in?" I asked.
"Now isn't really the best time," she said.
"Why not?"
"I'm in the middle of something."
"What kind of something?"
"Is that any of your business?" Is that a rhetorical question?
Yes.
Do you have a job?
Yes.
What's your job?
I am an epidemiologist.
You study diseases?
Yes.
Fascinating.
Listen, I don't know what it is you need, but if it has to do with that envelope, I'm sure I can't help.
I'm extremely thirsty, I said, touching my throat, which is the universal sign for thirsty.
There's a deli on the corner.
Actually, I'm diabetic and I need some sugar ASAP.
Lie number 35. Do you mean ASAP?
Anyway, I didn't feel great about lying, and I didn't believe in being able to know what's going to happen before it happens. But for some reason, I knew I had to get inside her apartment. In exchange for the lie, I made a promise to myself that when I got a raise in my allowance, I would donate part of that raise to people who in reality do have diabetes. She took a heavy breath, like she was incredibly frustrated. But on the other hand, she didn't ask me to leave. A man's voice called from inside, but I couldn't hear what it said.
Orange juice? She asked.
Do you have any coffee?
Follow me, she said, and she walked into the apartment.
What about non-dairy creamer? I got a look around as I followed her, and everything was clean and perfect. There were neat photographs on the walls, including one where you could see an African-American woman's VJ, which made me feel self-conscious. Where are the sofa cushions?
It doesn't have cushions.
What's that?
You mean the painting?
Your apartment smells good. The man in the other room called again, this time extremely loudly, like he was desperate, but she didn't pay any attention, like she didn't hear it, or didn't care. I touched a lot of things in her kitchen, because it made me feel okay for some reason. I ran my finger along the top of her microwave, and it turned gray.
C'est sale, I said, showing it to her, and cracking up.
She became extremely serious.
That's embarrassing, she said.
You should see my laboratory, I said.
I wonder how that could have happened, she said.
I said, things get dirty.
But I like to keep things clean. A woman comes by every week to clean. I've told her a million times to clean everywhere. I've even pointed that out to her.
I asked her why she was getting so upset about such a small thing. She said, it doesn't feel small to me. And I thought about moving a single grain of sand 1 millimeter. I took a wet wipe from my field kit and cleaned the microwave. Since you're an epidemiologist, I said, did you know that 70% of household dust is actually composed of human epidermal matter?
No, she said, I didn't.
I'm an amateur epidemiologist.
There aren't many of those.
Yeah. And I conducted a pretty fascinating experiment once where I told Felice to save all the dust from our apartment for a year in a garbage bag for me. Then I weighed it. It weighed 112 pounds. Then I figured out that 70% of 112 pounds is 78.4 pounds. I weigh 76 pounds, 78 pounds when I'm sopping wet. That doesn't actually prove anything, but it's weird. Where can I put this?
Here, she said, taking the wet wipe from me.
I asked her, why are you sad?
Excuse me?
You're sad. Why?
The coffee machine gurgled.
She opened a cabinet and took out a mug.
Do you take sugar?
I told her yes, because Dad always took sugar. As soon as she sat down, she got back up and took a bowl of grapes from her refrigerator. She also took out cookies and put them on a plate.
Do you like strawberries? She asked.
Yes, I told her, but I'm not hungry. She put out some strawberries. I thought it was weird that there weren't any menus or little magnetic calendars or pictures of kids on her refrigerator. The only thing in the whole kitchen was a photograph of an elephant on the wall next to the phone. I love that, I told her, and not just because I wanted her to like me.
You love what?
She asked. I pointed at the picture. Thank you, she said. I like it too. I said I loved it.
Yes, I love it.
How much do you know about elephants?
Not too much.
Not too much a little or not too much nothing?
Hardly anything.
For example, did you know that scientists used to think that elephants had ESP?
Do you mean ESP?
Anyway, elephants can set up meetings from very far away locations, and they know where their friends and enemies are going to be, and they can find water without any geological clues. No one could figure out how they do all of those things. So, what's actually going on?
I don't know.
How do they do it?
It?
How do they set up meetings if they don't have ESP?
You're asking me?
Yes.
I don't know.
Do you want to know?
Sure.
A lot?
Sure.
They're making very, 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 very deep calls. Way deeper than what humans can hear. They're talking to each other. Isn't that so awesome?
It is.
I ate a strawberry. There's this woman who spent the last couple of years in the Congo or wherever. She's been making recordings of the calls and putting together an enormous library of them. This past year, she started playing them back.
Playing them back?
To the elephants.
Why?
I loved that she asked why. As you probably know, elephants have much, much stronger memories than other mammals.
Yes, I think I knew that.
So this woman wanted to see just how good their memories actually are. She'd play the call of an enemy that was recorded a bunch of years earlier, a call they'd heard only once, and they'd get panicky, and sometimes they'd run. They remembered hundreds of calls, thousands. There might not even be a limit. Isn't that fascinating?
It is.
But what's really fascinating is that she'd play the call of a dead elephant to its family members.
And?
They remembered.
What did they do?
They approached the speaker.
I wonder what they were feeling.
What do you mean?
When they heard the calls of their dead, was it with love that they approached the jeep, or fear, or anger?
I don't remember.
Did they charge?
I don't remember.
Did they cry?
Only humans can cry tears, did you know that?
It looks like the elephant in that photograph is crying. I got extremely close to the picture, and it was true. It was probably manipulated in Photoshop, I said. But just in case, can I take a picture of your picture? She nodded and said, Didn't I read somewhere that elephants are the only other animals that bury their dead? No, I told her as I focused Grandpa's camera. You didn't. They just gather the bones. Only humans bury their dead.
Elephants couldn't believe in ghosts.
That made me crack up a little. Well, most scientists wouldn't say so.
What would you say?
I'm just an amateur scientist.
And what would you say?
I took the picture. I'd say they were confused. Then she started to cry tears.
I thought, I'm the one who's supposed to be crying. Don't cry, I told her.
Why not? She asked.
Because, I told her.
Because what? She asked.
Since I didn't know why she was crying, I couldn't think of a reason. Was she crying about the elephants? Or something else I'd said? Or the desperate person in the other room? Or something that I didn't know about? I told her, I bruise easily. She said, I'm sorry. I told her,
I wrote a letter to that scientist who's making those elephant recordings. I asked if I could be her assistant. I told her I could make sure there were always blank tapes ready for recording, and I could boil all the water so it was safe to drink, or even just carry her equipment. Her assistant wrote back to tell me she already had an assistant, obviously, but maybe there'd be a project in the future we could work on together.
That's great. Something to look forward to.
Yeah.
Someone came to the door of the kitchen, who I guessed was the man that had been calling from the other room. He just stuck his head in extremely quickly, said something I didn't understand, and walked away. Abby pretended to ignore it, but I didn't.
Who was that?
My husband.
Does he need something?
I don't care.
But he's your husband, and I think he needs something.
She cried more tears. I went over to her, and I put my hand on her shoulder, like Dad used to do with me. I asked her what she was feeling, because that's what he'd ask.
"You must think this is very unusual," she said.
"I think a lot of things are very unusual," I said. She asked, "How old are you?" I told her 12, lie number 59, because I wanted to be old enough for her to love me.
"What's a 12-year-old doing, knocking on the doors of strangers?"
"I'm trying to find a lock. How old are you?"
48.
"Jose, you look much younger than that."
She cracked up through her crying and said, "Thanks."
"What's a 48-year-old doing inviting strangers into her kitchen?"
"I don't know."
"I'm being annoying," I said.
"You're not being annoying," she said, "but it's extremely hard to believe someone when they tell you that."
I asked, "Are you sure you didn't know Thomas Schell?"
She said, "I didn't know Thomas Schell."
But for some reason, I still didn't believe her. "Maybe you know someone else with the first name Thomas, or someone else with the last name Schell?"
"No."
I kept thinking there was something she wasn't telling me. I showed her the little envelope again. "But this is your last name, right?" She looked at the writing, and I could see that she recognized something about it. Or I thought I could see it.
But then she said, "I'm sorry. I don't think I can help you."
"And what about the key?"
"What key?"
I realized I hadn't even shown it to her yet. All of that talking about dust, about elephants, and I hadn't gotten to the whole reason I was there. I pulled the key out from under my shirt and put it in her hand.
Because the string was still around my neck, when she leaned in to look at the key, her face came incredibly close to my face. We were frozen there for a long time. It was like time was stopped. I thought about the falling body.
"I'm sorry," she said.
"Why are you sorry?"
"I'm sorry I don't know anything about the key."
Disappointment number 3.
"I'm sorry, too."
Our faces were so incredibly close. I told her, "The fall play this fall is Hamlet, in case you're interested. I'm Yorick. We have a working fountain. If you want to come opening night, it's 12 weeks from now. It should be pretty great." She said, "I'll try." And I could feel the breath of her words against my face. I asked her, "Could we kiss for a little bit?"
"Excuse me?" she said, although on the other hand she didn't pull her head back.
"It's just that I like you, and I think I can tell that you like me." She said, "I don't think that's a good idea."
Disappointment number 4.
I asked why not. She said, "Because I'm 48 and you're 12.
"So?"
"And I'm married."
"So?"
"And I don't even know you."
"Don't you feel like you know me?" She didn't say anything. I told her, humans are the only animal that blushes, laughs, has religion, wages war, and kisses with lips. So in a way, the more you kiss with lips, the more human you are.
And the more you wage war?
Then I was the silent one.
She said, "You're a sweet, sweet boy."
I said, "Young man."
"But I don't think it's a good idea."
"Does it have to be a good idea?"
"I think it does."
"Can I at least take a picture of you?"
"That would be nice."
But when I started focusing Grandpa's camera, she put her hand in front of her face for some reason. I didn't want to force her to explain herself, so I thought of a different picture I could take, which would be more truthful anyway.
"Here's my card," I told her, "in case you remember anything about the key or just want to talk." My card said, "Oscar Schell, inventor, jewelry designer, jewelry fabricator, amateur entomologist, francophile, vegan, origamist, pacifist, percussionist, amateur astronomer, computer consultant, amateur archaeologist, collector of rare coins, butterflies that died natural deaths, miniature cacti, Beatles memorabilia,
and semi-precious stones, and other things.
Email, Oscar_Schell@hotmail.com. Home phone, private. Cell phone, private. Fax machine. I don't have a fax machine yet." I went over to Grandma's apartment when I got home, which is what I did basically every afternoon, because Mom worked at the firm on Saturdays and sometimes even Sundays, and she got panicky about me being alone. As I got near Grandma's building, I looked up and didn't see her sitting at her window waiting for me like she always did. I asked Farley if she was there, and he said he thought so, so I went up the 72 stairs.
I rang the doorbell. She didn't answer, so I opened the door, because she always leaves it unlocked, even though I don't think that's safe, because sometimes people who seem good end up being not as good as you might have hoped.
As I walked in, she was walking to the door. It looked almost like she'd been crying, but I knew that was impossible, because once she told me that she emptied herself of tears when Grandpa left. I told her fresh tears are produced every time you cry. She said, "Anyway." Sometimes I wondered if she cried when no one was looking. "Oscar," she said, and lifted me from the ground with one of her hugs. "I'm okay," I said. "Oscar," she said again, picking me up in another hug. "I'm okay," I said again, and then I asked her where she'd been. "I was in the guest room, talking to the renter." When I was a baby, Grandma would take care of me during the day. Dad told me that she'd give me baths in the sink and trim my fingernails and toenails with her teeth because she was afraid of using clippers. When I was old enough to take baths in the bathtub and to know I had a penis and a scrotum and everything, I asked her not to sit in the room with me.
"Why not?"
"Privacy."
"Privacy from what? From me?"
I didn't want to hurt her feelings, because not hurting her feelings is another of my raison d'être. "Just privacy," I said. She put her hands on her stomach and said, "From me?"
She agreed to wait outside, but only if I held a ball of yarn, which went under the bathroom door and was connected to the scarf she was knitting. Every few seconds, she'd give it a tug and I had to tug back, undoing what she'd just done, so that she could know that I was okay. She was taking care of me when I was 4, chasing me around the apartment like she was a monster, and I cut my top lip against the end of our coffee table and had to go to the hospital. Grandma believes in God, but she doesn't believe in taxis, so I bled on my shirt on the bus. Dad told me it gave her incredibly heavy boots, even though my lip only needed a couple of stitches, and that she kept coming across the street to tell him, "It was all my fault. You should never let him be around me again." The next time I saw her after that, she told me, "You see, I was pretending to be a monster, and I became a monster." Grandma stayed at our apartment the week after Dad died, while Mom was going around Manhattan putting up posters. We had thousands of thumb wars, and I won every single one, even the ones I was trying to lose. We watched documentaries and cooked vegan cupcakes and went for lots of walks in the park. One day, I wandered away from her and hid. I liked the way it felt to have someone look for me, to hear my name again and again. Oscar! Oscar! Maybe I didn't even like it, but I needed it. I followed her around from a safe distance as she started to get incredibly panicky. Oscar! She was crying and touching everything, but I wouldn't let her know where I was because I was sure that the cracking up at the end would make it all okay. I watched her as she walked home, where I knew she would sit on the stoop of our building and wait for Mom to come back. She would have to tell her I had disappeared, and that because she wasn't watching me closely enough, I was gone forever, and there'd be no more shells. I ran ahead down 82nd Street and up 83rd, and when she came up to the building, I jumped out from behind the door. "But I didn't order a pizza," I said, cracking up so hard I thought my neck would burst. She started to say something, and then she stopped. Stan took her arm and said, "Why don't you sit down, Grandma?" She told him, "Don't touch me," in a voice that I'd never heard from her. Then she turned around and went across the street to her apartment. That night, I looked through my binoculars at her window, and there was a note that said, "Don't go away." Ever since that day, whenever we go on walks, she makes us play a game like Marco Polo, where she calls my name and I have to call back to let her know that I'm okay. "Oscar! I'm okay! Oscar! I'm okay!" I'm never exactly sure when we're playing the game and when she's just saying my name, so I always let her know that I'm okay.
A few months after Dad died, Mom and I went to the storage facility in New Jersey, where Dad kept the stuff that he didn't use anymore but might use again one day, like when he retired, I guess. We rented a car, and it took us more than 2 hours to get there, even though it wasn't far away, because Mom kept stopping to go to the bathroom and wash her face. The facility wasn't organized very well, and it was dark, so it took us a long time to find Dad's little room. We got in a fight about his razor, because she said it should go in the throw-it-away pile, and I told her it should go in the save-it pile. She said, "Save it for what?" I said, "It doesn't matter for what." She said, "I don't know why he saved a $3 razor in the first place." I said, "It doesn't matter why." She said, "We can't save everything." I said, "So it'll be okay if I throw away all of your things and forget about you after you die?" As it was coming out of my mouth, I wished it was going into my mouth. She said she was sorry, which I thought was weird. One of the things we found were the old two-way radios from when I was a baby. Mom and Dad put one in the crib so they could hear me crying, and sometimes, instead of coming to the crib, Dad would just talk into it, which would help me get to sleep. I asked Mom why he kept those. She said, "Probably for when you have kids." What the? That's what Dad was like. I started to realize that a lot of the stuff he'd saved, boxes and boxes of Legos, the set of How It Works books, even the empty photo albums, was probably for when I had kids. I don't know why, but for some reason that made me angry. Anyway, I put in new batteries, and I thought it would be a fun way for me and Grandma to talk, so I gave her the baby one so she wouldn't have to figure out any buttons. It worked great. When I'd wake up, I'd tell her good morning, and before I'd go to bed, we'd usually talk. She was always waiting for me on the other end. I don't know how she knew when I'd be there. Maybe she just waited around all day. "Grandma, do you read me?" "Oscar? I'm okay. Over." "How did you sleep, darling? Over." "What?" I couldn't hear that. "Over." "I asked, how did you sleep? Over." "Fine.
I'll say, looking at her across the street, my chin in my palm. No bad dreams. Over. $100. Over.
We never have all that much to say to each other. She tells me the same stories about Grandpa again and again, like how his hands were rough from making so many sculptures, and how he could talk to animals.
You'll come visit me this afternoon? Over?
Yeah, I think so. Over.
Please try. Over.
I'll try. Over and out. Some nights, I took the two-way radio into bed with me and rested it on the side of the pillow that Buckminster wasn't on, so I could hear what was going on in her bedroom. Sometimes, she'd wake me up in the middle of the night. It gave me heavy boots that she had nightmares, because I didn't know what she was dreaming about, and there was nothing I could do to help her. She hollered, which woke me up, obviously, so my sleep depended on her sleep, and when I told her, "No bad dreams," I was talking about her. Grandma knitted me white sweaters, white mittens, and white hats. She knew how much I liked dehydrated ice cream, which was one of my very few exceptions to veganism, because it's what astronauts have for dessert, and she went to the Hayden Planetarium and bought it for me. She picked up pretty rocks to give to me, even though she shouldn't have been carrying heavy things, and usually they were just Manhattan schist anyway.
A couple of days after the worst day, when I was on my way to my first appointment with Dr. Fine, I saw Grandma carrying a huge rock across Broadway. It was as big as a baby and must have weighed a ton. But she never gave that one to me, and she never mentioned it.
Oscar, I'm okay.
One afternoon, I mentioned to Grandma that I was considering starting a stamp collection, and the next afternoon, she had three albums for me, and, "Because I love you so much it hurts me, and because I want your wonderful collection to have a wonderful beginning," a sheet of stamps of great American inventors. "You've got Thomas Edison," she said, pointing at one of the stamps, "and Ben Franklin, Henry Ford, Eli Whitney, Alexander Graham Bell, George Washington Carver, Nikola Tesla, whoever that is, the Wright brothers, J. Robert Oppenheimer." "Who's he?" "He invented the bomb."
"Which bomb?"
"The bomb."
"He wasn't a great inventor."
She said, "Who said great was good?"
"Grandma."
"Yes, darling."
"It's just that, where's the plate block?"
"The what?"
"The thing on the side of the sheet with the numbers."
"With the numbers?"
"Yeah."
"I got rid of it."
"You what?"
"I got rid of it. Was that wrong?"
I felt myself getting worked up, even though I was trying not to. "Well, it's not worth anything without the plate block."
"What?"
"The plate block. These stamps aren't worth anything."
She looked at me for a few seconds. "Yeah," she said. "I guess I heard of that. So I'll go back to the stamp shop tomorrow and get another sheet. These we can use for the mail." "There's no reason to get another," I told her, wanting to take back the last few things I said and try them again, being nicer this time, being a better grandson, or just a silent one. "There is a reason, Oscar. I'm okay."
We spent so much time together. I don't think there's anyone that I spent more time with, at least not since Dad died, unless you count Buckminster. But there were a lot of people that I knew better. For example, I didn't know anything about what it was like when she was a kid, or how she met Grandpa, or what their marriage was like, or why he left. If I had to write her life story, all I could say is that her husband could talk to animals and that I should never love anything as much as she loved me. So here's my question. What were we spending so much time doing if not getting to know each other?
"Did you do anything special today?" she asked that afternoon I started my search for the lock. When I think about everything that happened, from when we buried the coffin to when I dug it up,
I always think about how I could have told her the truth then. It wasn't too late to turn around. Before I got to the place